two are one, life and death lying together.
It was a little like being inside a tent up on the ice, but without shelter, without food, without rest. Nothing left but our companionship, and that soon to end. The sky hazed over during the afternoon, and the temperature began to drop. Even in the windless hollow it became too cold to sit motionless. We had to move about, and still around sunset I was taken by fits of shuddering like those I had experienced in the prison truck crossing Ogorain. The darkness seemed to take forever coming in. In the late blue twilight we left the dell and went creeping behind trees and bushes over the hill till we could make out the line of the border fence, a few dim dots along the pallid snow. No lights, nothing moving, no sound. Away off in the southwest shone the yellow glimmer of a small town, some tiny commensal village of Ogorain, where Estravan could go with his unacceptable identification papers and be assured at least of a night's lodging in the commensal jail or perhaps on the nearest commensal voluntary farm. All at once, there, at that last moment, no sooner, I realized what my selfishness and Estravan's silence had kept from me, where he was going and what he was getting into. I said, "Theram, wait." But he was off, downhill. A magnificent fast skier, and this time not holding back for me. He shot away on a long, quick, curving descent through the shadows over the snow. He ran from me and straight into the guns of the border guards. I think they shouted warnings or orders to halt, and a light sprang up somewhere, but I am not sure in any case he did not stop but flashed on towards the fence. And they shot him down before he reached it. They did not use the sonic stunners, but the foray gun, the ancient weapon that fires a set of metal fragments in a burst. They shot to kill him. He was dying when I got to him, sprawled and twisted away from his skis that stuck up out of the snow, his chest half shot away. I took his head in my arms and spoke to him, but he never answered me. Only, in a way, he answered my love for him, crying out through the silent wreck and tumult of his mind, as consciousness lapsed, and the unspoken tongue, once, clearly, "Arrak." Then no more. I held him, crouching there in the snow, while he died. They let me do that. Then they made me get up, and took me off one way and him another. I going to prison, and he into the dark. Chapter 20. A Fool's Errand. Somewhere in the notes Estravan wrote during our trek across the Gobrin ice, he wonders why his companion is ashamed to cry. I could have told him even then there was not shame so much as fear. Now I went on through the Sinoth Valley, through the evening of his death into the cold country that lies beyond fear. There I found you can weep all you like, but there's no good in it. I was taken back to Sassanoth and imprisoned, because I had been in the company of an outlaw, and probably because they did not know what else to do with me. From the start, even before official orders came from Erenrung, they treated me well. My Karhaitis jail was a finished room in the Tower of the Lords Elect in Sassanoth. I had a fireplace, a radio, and 5 large meals daily. It was not comfortable, the bed was hard, the covers thin, the floor bare, the air cold, like any room in Karhaid. But they sent in a physician, in whose hands and voice was a more enduring, a more profitable comfort than any I ever found in Ogorain. After he came, I think the door was left unlocked. I recall it standing open and myself wishing it were shut because of the chill draft of air from the hall. But I had not the strength, the courage, to get off my bed and shut my prison door. The physician, a grave, maternal young fellow, told me with an air of peaceable certainty, "You have been underfed and overtaxed for 5 or 6 months. You have spent yourself. There's nothing more to spend. Lie down, rest. Lie down like the rivers frozen in the valleys in winter. Lie still. Wait. But when I slept, I was always in the truck, huddling together with the others, all of us stinking, shivering, naked, squeezed together for warmth, all but one. One lay by himself against the barred door, the cold one, with a mouth full of clotted blood. He was the traitor. He had gone on by himself, deserting us, deserting me. I would wake up full of rage, a feebly shaky rage that turned into feeble tears. I must have been rather ill, for I remember some of the effects of high fever, and the physician stayed with me one night, or perhaps more. I can't recall those nights, but do remember saying to him, and hearing the querulous, keening note in my own voice, he could have stopped. He saw the guards. He ran right into the guns. The young physician said nothing for a while. You're not saying that he killed himself? Perhaps. That's a bitter thing to say of a friend. And I will not believe it of Harthrem Yresravin. I had not had in mind when I spoke the contemptibility of suicide to these people. It is not to them, as to us, an option. It is the abdication from option, the act of betrayal itself. To a Karheider, reading our canons, the crime of Judas lies not in his betrayal of Christ, but in the act that, sealing despair, denies the chance of forgiveness, change, life. His suicide. Then you don't call him, Estravan, the traitor? Nor ever did. There are many who never heeded the accusations against him, Mr. I. But I was unable to see any solace in that, and only cried out in the same torment, Then why did they shoot him? Why is he dead? To this he made no answer, there being none. I was never formally interrogated. They asked how I had got out of Puleffin Farm and into Karheide, and they asked the destination and intent of the code message I had sent on their radio. I told them. That information went straight to Erenrang, to the king. The matter of the ship was apparently held secret, but the news of my escape from an Orgota prison, my journey over the ice in winter, my presence in Sassenoth, was freely reported and discussed. Estravan's part in this was not mentioned on the radio, nor was his death. Yet it was known. Secrecy in Karheide is, to an extraordinary extent, a matter of discretion, of an agreed, understood silence, an omission of questions, yet not an omission of answers. The bulletins spoke only of the envoy, Mr. I, but everybody knew that it was Harth Remir Estravan who had stolen me from the hands of the Orgota and come with me over the ice to Karheide to give the staring lie to the Commensal's tale of my sudden death from horn fever in Mishnori last autumn. Estravan had predicted the effects of my return fairly accurately. He had erred mainly in underestimating them. Because of the alien who lay ill, not acting, not caring, in a room in Sassenoth, two governments fell within 10 days. To say that an Orgota government fell means, of course, only that one group of commensals replaced another group of commensals in the controlling officers of the 33. Some shadows got shorter, and some longer, as they say in Karheide. The Sarf faction that had sent me off to Puleffin hung on, despite the not unprecedented embarrassment of being caught lying, until Argaven's public announcement of the imminent arrival of the starship in Karheide. That day, Opsle's party, the Open Trade faction, took over the presiding officers of the 33. So I was of some service to them, after all. In Karheide, the fall of a government is most likely to mean the disgrace and replacement of a prime minister, along with a reshuffling of the Kyorami. Although assassination, abdication, and insurrection are all frequent alternatives. Tybe made no effort to hang on. My current value in the game of international Shifgrether, plus my vindication, by implication, of Estravan, gave me, as it were, a prestige weight so clearly surpassing his that he resigned, as I later learned, even before the Erenrang government knew that I had radioed to my ship. He acted on the tip-off from Thesiger, waited only until he got word of Estrafan's death, and then resigned. He had his defeat, and his revenge for it, all in one. Once Argaven was fully informed, he sent me a summons, a request to come at once to Erenrang, and along with it, a liberal allowance for expenses. The city of Sassanoth, with equal liberality, sent their young physician along with me, for I was not in very good shape yet. We made the trip in power sledges. I remember only parts of it. It was smooth and unhurried, with long halts waiting for packers to clear the road, and long nights spent at inns. It could only have taken 2 or 3 days, but it seemed a long trip, and I can't recall much of it till the moment when we came through the northern gates of Erenrang into the deep streets full of snow and shadow. I felt then that my heart hardened somewhat, and my mind cleared. I had been all in pieces, disintegrated. Now, though tired from the easy journey, I found some strength left whole in me. Strength of habit, most likely, for here at last was a place I knew, a city I had lived in, worked in for over a year. I knew the streets, the towers, the somber courts and ways and facades of the palace. I knew my job here. Therefore, for the first time, it came plainly to me that, my friend being dead, I must accomplish the thing he died for. I must set the keystone in the arch. At the palace gates the order was for me to proceed to one of the guest houses within the palace walls. It was the round tower dwelling which signalled a high degree of Shifgrethor in the court, not so much the king's favour as his recognition of a status already high. Ambassadors from friendly powers were usually lodged there. It was a good sign. To get to it, however, we had to pass by the corner red dwelling. And I looked in the narrow arched gateway at the bare tree over the pool, grey with ice, and the house that still stood empty. At the door of the round tower, I was met by a person in white hib and crimson shirt with a silver chain over his shoulders, Foxa, the foreteller of other hoard fastness. At sight of his kind and handsome face, the first known face that I had seen for many days, a rush of relief softened my mood of strained resolution. When Foxa took my hands in the rare Karhidish greeting and welcomed me as his friend, I could make some response to his warmth. He had been sent to the Kyoremi from his district, South Rear, early in the autumn. Election of council members from the indwellers of Andara fastnesses is not uncommon. It is, however, not common for a weaver to accept office, and I believe Foxa would have refused if he had not been much concerned by Tybe's government and the direction in which it was leading the country. So he had taken off the weaver's gold chain and put on the councillor's silver one, and he had not spent long in making his mark, for he had been since Thern a member of the Hes-Kyoremi of Inner Council, which serves as counterweight to the Prime Minister, and it was the king who had named him to that position. He was perhaps on his way up to the eminence from which Estravan less than a year ago had fallen. Political careers in Karhide are abrupt, precipitous. In the round tower, a cold, pompous little house, Foxa and I talked at some length before I had to see anyone else or make any formal statement or appearance. He asked with his clear gaze on me, "There is a ship coming, then, coming down to Earth, a larger ship than the one you came to Horden Island on 3 years ago. Is that right?" "Yes, that is, I sent a message that should prepare it to come." "When will it come?" When I realized that, I did not even know what day of the month it was. I began to realize how badly off I had in fact been lately. I had to count back to the day before Estravan's death, when I found that the ship, if it had been at minimum distance, would already be in planetary orbit, awaiting some word from me. I had another shock. "I must communicate with the ship. They'll want instructions. Where does the king want them to come down? It should be an uninhabited area, fairly large. I must get to a transmitter." Everything was arranged expeditiously with ease. The endless convolutions and frustrations of my previous dealings with the Erenrang government were melted away like an ice pack in a flooding river. The wheel turned. Next day I was to have an audience with the king. It had taken Estravan 6 months to arrange my first audience. It had taken the rest of his life to arrange this second one. I was too tired to be apprehensive this time, and there were things on my mind that outweighed self-consciousness. I went down the long red hall under the dusty banners and stood before the dais with its three great hearths, where three bright fires cracked and sparkled. The king sat by the central fireplace, hunched up on a carven stool by the table.
"Sit down, Mr. Eye."
I sat down across the hearth from Argovan, and saw his face in the light of the flames. He looked unwell and old. He looked like a woman who has lost her baby, like a man who has lost his son.
"Well, Mr. Eye, so your ship's going to land?"
"It will land in Uft and Fen, as you requested, sir. They should bring it down this evening, at the beginning of third hour."
"What if they miss the place? Will they burn everything up?"
"They'll follow a radio beam straight in. That's all been arranged. They won't miss."
"And how many of them are there? 11? Is that right?"
"Yes. Not enough to be afraid of, my lord." Argovan's hands twitched in an unfinished gesture.
"I am no longer afraid of you, Mr. Eye."
"I'm glad of that."
"You've served me well."
"But I am not your servant."
"I know it," he said indifferently. He stared at the fire, chewing the inside of his lip.
"My Ansible transmitter is in the hands of the Sarf in Mishnori, presumably. However, when the ship comes down, it will have an Ansible aboard. I will have thenceforth, if acceptable to you, the position of envoy plenipotentiary of the Ecumen, and will be empowered to discuss and sign a treaty of alliance with Karhide. All this can be confirmed with Hain and the various civilities by Ansible."
"Very well."
I said no more, for he was not giving me his whole attention. He moved a log in the fire with his boot toe so that a few red sparks crackled up from it.
"Why the devil did he cheat me?"
he demanded in his high, strident voice, and for the first time looked straight at me.
"Who?"
I said, sending back his stare.
"Estraven."
"He saw to it that you didn't cheat yourself. He got me out of sight when you began to favor a faction unfriendly to me. He brought me back to you when my return would in itself persuade you to receive the mission of the Ecumen and the credit for it."
"Why did he never say anything about this larger ship to me?"
"Because he didn't know about it. I never spoke to anyone of it until I went to Orgorain."
"And a fine lot you chose to blab to there, you two. He tried to get the Orgota to receive your mission. He was working with their open traders all along. You'll tell me that was not betrayal?"
"It was not. He knew that whichever nation first made alliance with the Ecumen, the other would follow soon. As it will, as Sith and Tarunter and the archipelago will also follow until you find unity. He loved his country very dearly, sir. But he did not serve it or you. He served the master I serve."
"The Ecumen?"
said Argovan, startled. "No. Mankind." As I spoke, I did not know if what I said was true. True in part, an aspect of the truth. It would be no less true to say that Estraven's acts had risen out of pure personal loyalty, a sense of responsibility and friendship towards one single human being, myself. Nor would that be the whole truth." The king made no reply. His somber, pouched, furrowed face was turned again to the fire.
"Why did you call to this ship of yours before you notified me of your return to Karhide?"
"To force your hand, sir. A message to you would also have reached Lord Tybe, who might have handed me over to the Orgota, or had me shot, as he had my friend shot." The king said nothing. "My own survival doesn't matter all that much. But I have and had then a duty towards Gethin and the Ecumen, a task to fulfill. I signaled the ship first to ensure myself some chance of fulfilling it. That was Estraven's counsel, and it was right."
"Well, it was not wrong. At any rate, they'll land here. We shall be the first. And they're all like you, eh? All perverts, always in Kemmer? A queer lot to vie for the honor of receiving. Tell Lord Gorchern, the Chamberlain, how they expect to be received. See to it that there's no offense or omission. They'll be lodged in the palace, wherever you think suitable. I wish to show them honor. You've done me a couple of good turns, Mr. Eye. made liars of the commensals, and then fools.
And presently allies, my lord.
I know, he said surely. But Carhide first. Carhide first.
I nodded. After some silence, he said,
How was it, that pull across the ice?
Not easy.
Estevan would be a good man to pull with, on a crazy trek like that. He was tough as iron, and never lost his temper. I'm sorry he's dead.
I found no reply.
I'll receive your countrymen in audience tomorrow afternoon at second hour. Is there more need saying now?
My lord, will you revoke the order of exile on Estevan to clear his name?
Not yet, Mr. I. Don't rush it. Anything more?
No more.
Go on, then.
Even I betrayed him. I had said I would not bring the ship down till his banishment was ended, his name cleared. I could not throw away what he had died for by insisting on the condition. It would not bring him out of this exile. The rest of that day went in arranging with Lord Gortgern and others for the reception and lodging of the ship's company. At second hour we set out by power sledge to Aften Fen, about 30 miles northeast of Erenram. The landing site was at the near edge of the great desolate region, a peat marsh too boggy to be farmed or settled, and now in mid-Irem a flat frozen waste many feet deep in snow. The radio beacon had been functioning all day, and they had received confirmation signals from the ship. On the screens, coming in, the crew must have seen the Terminator lying clear across the great continent along the border from Guthan Bay to the Gulf of Cherasun, and the peaks of the Kargev still in sunlight, a chain of stars. For it was twilight when we, looking up, saw the one star descending. She came down in a roar and glory, and steam went roaring up white as her stabilizers went down in the great lake of water and mud created by the retro. Down underneath the bog there was permafrost like granite, and she came to rest balanced neatly and sat cooling over the quickly refreezing lake, a great, delicate fish balanced on its tail, dark silver in the twilight of winter. Beside me, Faxa of Otherhord spoke for the first time since the sound and splendor of the ship's descent.
"I'm glad I have lived to see this," he said.
So Estevan had said when he looked at the ice, at death, so he should have said this night. To get away from the bitter regret that beset me, I started to walk forward over the snow towards the ship. She was frosted already by the inter-hull coolants, and as I approached, the high port slid open, and the exitway was extruded, a graceful curve down onto the ice. The first off was long Heo-Heu, unchanged, of course, precisely as I had last seen her 3 years ago in my life and a couple of weeks in hers. She looked at me and at Faxa, and at the others of the escort who had followed me, and stopped at the foot of the ramp. She said solemnly in Karhidish, "I have come in friendship." To her eyes we were all aliens. I let Faxa greet her first. He indicated me to her, and she came and took my right hand, in the fashion of my people, looking into my face.
"Oh, Ginley," she said, "I didn't know you." It was strange to hear a woman's voice after so long.
The others came out of the ship on my advice. Evidence of any mistrust at this point would humiliate the Kahedish escort, impugning their ship Grethor. Out they came, and met the Kahedis with a beautiful courtesy. But they all looked strange to me, men and women, well as I knew them. Their voices sounded strange, too deep, too shrill. They were like a troop of great, strange animals of two different species, great apes with intelligent eyes, all of them in rut, in Kemmer. They took my hand, touched me, held me. I managed to keep myself in control and to tell Heo, Heyu, and Tullier what they most urgently needed to know about the situation they had entered during the sledge ride back to Erenrang. When we got to the palace, however, I had to get to my room at once. The physician from Sasanoth came in, his quiet voice and his face, a young, serious face, not a man's face and not a woman's, a human face. These were a relief to me. Familiar. Right. But he said, after ordering me to get to bed and dosing me with some mild tranquilizer, "I've seen your fellow envoys. This is a marvelous thing, the coming of men from the stars, and in my lifetime." There again was the delight, the courage that is most admirable in the Carhider spirit, and in the human spirit. And though I could not share it with him, to deny it would be a detestable act, I said, without sincerity but with absolute truth, "It is a marvelous thing indeed for them as well, the coming to a new world, a new mankind." At the end of that spring, late in Tua, when the thaw floods were going down and travel was possible again, I took a vacation from my little embassy in Erenrang and went east. My people were spread out by now all over the planet. Since we had been authorized to use the air cars, Heo Heyu and three others had taken one and flown over to Sif and the archipelago, nations of the sea hemisphere, which I had entirely neglected. Others were in Ogorain, and two, reluctant, in Perunter, where the thaws do not even begin until Tua, and everything refreezes, they say, a week later. Tulir and Ketsta were getting on very well in Erenrang, and could handle what might come up. Nothing was urgent. After all, a ship setting out at once from the closest of Winter's new allies could not arrive before 17 years planetary time had passed. It is a marginal world on the edge. Out beyond it, towards the South Orion Arm, no world has been found where men live. And it is a long way back from Winter to the prime worlds of the Ecumen, the hearth worlds of our race. 50 years to Hain Davenant, a man's lifetime to Earth. No hurry. I crossed the Kargav, this time on lower passes, on a road that winds along above the coast of the Southern Sea. I paid a visit to the first village I had stayed in, when the fishermen brought me in from Horden Island 3 years ago. The folk of that hearth received me, now as then, without the least surprise. I spent a week in the big port city, Thather, at the mouth of the River Inch, and then in early summer started on foot into Kermland. I walked east and south into the steep, harsh country full of crags and green hills and great rivers and lonely houses, till I came to Icefoot Lake. From the lake shore, looking up southward at the hills, I saw a light I knew. The blink, the white suffusion of the sky, the glare of the glacier lying high beyond. The ice was there. Ester was a very old place. Its hearth and outbuildings were all of gray stone cut from the steep mountainside to which it clung. It was bleak, full of the sound of wind. I knocked, and the door was opened. I said, "I ask the hospitality of the domain. I was a friend of Theram of Estra." The one who opened to me, a slight, grave-looking fellow of 19 or 20, accepted my words in silence and silently admitted me to the hearth. He took me to the wash-house, the tiring rooms, the great kitchen, and when he had seen to it that the stranger was clean, clothed, and fed, he left me to myself in a bedroom that looked down out of deep, slit windows over the grey lake and the grey Thor forests that lie between Estra and Stok. It was a bleak land, a bleak house. Fire roared in the deep hearth, giving, as always, more warmth for the eye and spirit than for the flesh. For the stone floor and walls, the wind outside blowing down off the mountains and the ice drank up most of the heat of the flames. But I did not feel the cold as I used to, my first 2 years in Winter. I had lived long in a cold land now. In an hour or so, the boy—he had a girl's quick delicacy in his looks and movements, but no girl could keep so grim a silence as he did—came to tell me that the Lord of Estra would receive me if it pleased me to come. I followed him downstairs through long corridors, where some kind of game of hide-and-seek was going on. Children shot by us, darted around us, little ones shrieking with excitement, adolescents slipping like shadows from door to door, hands over their mouths to keep laughter still. One fat little thing of 5 or 6 caromed into my legs, then plunged and grabbed my escort's hand for protection. "Sorve!" he squeaked, staring up wide-eyed at me all the time. "Sova, I'm going to hide in the brewery." Off he went like a round pebble from a sling. The young man, Sova, not at all discomposed, led me on and brought me into the inner hearth, to the Lord of Estra.
Estvan's hearth Remir Estraven was an old man, past 70, crippled by an arthritic disease of the hips. He sat erect in a rolling chair by the fire. His face was broad, much blunted and worn down by time, like a rock in a torrent. A calm face, terribly calm.
"You are the envoy, Genri I?"
"I am." He looked at me and I at him. Therim had been the son, child of the flesh of this old lord. Therim, the younger son, Arek the elder, that brother whose voice he had heard in mine, bespeaking him. Both dead now. I could not see anything of my friend in that worn, calm, hard old face that met my gaze. I found nothing there but the certainty, the sure fact of Therim's death. I had come on a fool's errand to Estra, hoping for solace. There was no solace. And why should a pilgrimage to the place of my friend's childhood make any difference, fill any absence, soothe any remorse? Nothing could be changed now. My coming to Estra had, however, another purpose, and this I could accomplish. I was with your son in the months before his death. I was with him when he died. I've brought you the journals he kept. And if there's anything I can tell you of those days... No particular expression showed on the old man's face. That calmness was not to be altered. But the young one with a sudden movement came out of the shadows into the light between the window and the fire, a bleak, uneasy light, and he spoke harshly. "In Erinrang, they still call him Estevan the traitor." The old lord looked at the boy, then at me.
"This is Sorvearth," he said, "heir of Estra, my son's son."
There is no ban on incest there, I knew it well enough. Only the strangeness of it, to me a Terran, and the strangeness of seeing the flash of my friend's spirit in this grim, fierce provincial boy, made me dumb for a while. When I spoke, my voice was unsteady. "The king will recant. Therim was no traitor. What does it matter what fools call him?" The old lord nodded slowly, smoothly.
"It matters," he said.
"You crossed the Gobern ice together," Sorva demanded. "You and he?"
"We did."
"I should like to hear that tale, my lord envoy," said old Esvans, very calm.
But the boy, Therim's son, said, stammering,
"Will you tell us how he died? Will you tell us about the other worlds out among the stars? The other kinds of men? The other lives?"
The End. And now, the Cassinian calendar and clock. The Year. Gethin's period of revolution is 8401 Terran Standard Hours, or 0.96 of the Terran Standard Year. The period of rotation is 23.08 Terran Standard Hours. The Gethinian year contains 364 days. In Karhide Orgarain, years are not numbered consecutively from a base year forward to the present. The base year is the current year. Every New Year's Day, Gethin Ithern, the year just passed becomes the year one ago, and every past date is increased by one. The future is similarly counted, next year being the year one to come, until it in turn becomes the year one. The inconvenience of this system in record-keeping is palliated by various devices, for instance, reference to well-known events, reigns of kings, dynasties, local lords, etc. The Omeshta count in 144-year cycles for the birth of Mestha 2,022 years ago in ecumenical year 1492, and keep ritual celebrations every 12th year, but this system is strictly cultic and is not officially employed even by the government of Orgeraine, which sponsors the Yomesh religion. The month. The period of revolution of Gethin's moon is 26 Gethinian days. The rotation is captured so that the moon presents the same face to the planet always. There are 14 months in the year, and as solar and lunar calendars concur so closely, that adjustment is required only about once in 200 years. The days of the month are invariable, as are the days of the phases of the moon. The Karhaitish names of the months. Winter, 1, Theron, 2, Thonairn, 3, Nimmer, 4, Honor. Spring, 5, Irem, 6, Moth, 7, Tuwa. Summer, 8, Osmi, 9, Okri, 10, Kus, 11, Hakana. Autumn, 12, Gore, 13, Susmi, 14, Grende. The 26-day month is divided into two half-months of 13 days. The day. The day, 23.08 Terran Standard Hours, is divided into 10 hours. Being invariable, the days of the month are generally referred to by name, like our days of the week, not by number. Many of the names refer to the phase of the moon, for example, Gethany, darkness, Arhad, first crescent, etc. The prefix odd, used in the second half month, is a reversive, giving a contrary meaning, so that odd Gethany might be translated as undarkness. The Karhaitish names of the days of the month. 1. Gethany. 2. Swordni. 3. Eps. 4. Arhad. 5. Netherhod. 6. Streth. 7. Berni. 8. Eorni. 9. Harhahad. 10. Guirni. 11. Irni. 12. Poste. 13. Tormenbad. 14. Odd Gethany. 15. Odd Swordni. 16. Odeps. 17. Odarhad. 18. Onetherhad. 19. Odstreth. 20. Odberni. 21. Odorni. 22. Odarhahad. 23. Odgwirni. 24. Odirni. 25. Aposthi. 26. Otormenbad. The hour. The decimal clock used in all Gethinian cultures converts as follows, very roughly, to the Terran double 12-hour clock. Note, this is a mere guide to the time of day implied by a Gethinian hour. The complexities of an exact conversion, given the fact that the Gethinian day contains only 23.08 Terran standard hours, are irrelevant to my purpose. First hour, noon to 2:30 p.m. Second hour, 2:30 to 5 p.m. Third hour, 5 to 7 p.m. Fourth hour, 7 to 9:30 p.m. Fifth hour, 9:30 to midnight. Sixth hour, midnight to 2:30 a.m. Seventh hour, 2:30 to 5 a.m. Eighth hour, 5 to 7 a.m. Ninth hour, 7 to 9:30 a.m. Tenth hour, 9:30 to noon. We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin, narrated by George Guidel. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. so look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.